chin and spills from his dark hair. No. Then something changes on the wind. An abrupt hush breaks over the island and sends a quick chill across the nape of my neck. The singing has stopped. Bo takes a step closer to the edge of the cliff, like he's straining to hear what is no longer there. "It's gone," he says. The sisters have all found bodies. The words seem pulled from my throat. The quiet settles between each of my ribs. It expands my lungs. It reminds me of what's to come. They've all returned. I close my eyes, focusing on the silence. It's the fastest it's ever happened before. Now, the drowning will begin. A warning. We wait for death. We hold our breath. We know it's coming, and still we flinch when it claws at our throats and pulls us under. Plaque located on the stone bench on Ocean Avenue, facing the harbor. Commissioned in 1925. Chapter 6. The soil squishes away beneath my rain boots. A steady, uninterrupted drizzle collects on the waterproof sleeves of my raincoat as I move back down the rows of the orchard. Bo is back in his cottage. We parted ways an hour ago. And even though I thought about going back to bed, my head still pounding, my skin rattling against my bones, I decided I wanted to be outside, alone. I find the familiar oak tree that grows at the center of the orchard, where Bo and I passed not long ago. But we didn't stop here. This is my favorite place on the island, where I feel protected and hidden among the old, rotted fruit trees, where I let memories slide over me like a cool stream. This oak tree stands alone among the rest, ancient and weathered from the sea air, its growth stunted. But it's been here since the beginning, nearly 200 years back when the Swan Sisters first stepped onto land, when they were still alive. I run my fingers along the crude heart etched into the wood, cut there by lovers long ago dead. But the heart remains, the bark fallen away, permanent. I slide down against the trunk of the tree and sit at its base, leaning my head back to look up at the sky, speckled with dark clouds caught in the fickle ocean winds. The swan season has begun, and this little town tucked along the shore will not come out unharmed. A storm is blowing in from the ocean. The clock beside my bed reads 11 p.m., then midnight. I can't sleep. I walk from my bedroom into the bathroom across the hall, my thoughts straying to Bo. He's not safe, even on the island. I can hear Mom's fan blowing in her room 2 doors down while she sleeps. She likes to feel a breeze, even in winter. She says she has nightmares without it. I flick on the bathroom light and look at myself in the mirror. My lips are pale, hair lying flat across my shoulders. I look like I haven't slept in days. And then a sliver of light blinks through the bathroom window and reflects back at me in the mirror. I lift a hand to block it. It's not the beam of light from the lighthouse. It's something else. I squint through the rain-streaked window. A boat is pulling up to the dock down on the lower bank. Someone is here. I shrug into my raincoat and boots and slip out the front door quietly. The wind howls over the rocky outcroppings on the island, blowing the hardy seagrass sideways and swirling my hair across my face. As I get closer, I see a light pass over the dock, a large flashlight, the kind used to see into the fog when you're trying to pick your way through the wreckage of the harbor back to port. There is a low exchange of voices and the stomping of feet on the wood dock. Whoever it is, they aren't trying to be quiet or covert. I lift a hand over my face to block the wind, and then I hear my name. Penny? In the dark, I make out Rose's wild hair caught up in the gust. Rose, what are you doing here?
We brought wine, says Heath Belzer, the boy who walked Rose home from the swan party last night.
and who was now standing beside her, holding up a bottle for me to see. The boat behind him has been secured sloppily to the dock, ropes hanging down into the water, and I assume it must be Heath's parents' boat.
The singing stopped, Rose says in a hush, like she doesn't want the island to hear.
I know. She takes several steps towards me, swaying a bit, obviously already a little intoxicated. Heath looks back at the harbor, the sea lapping against the dock. Out there in the darkness is where at least 3 boys' lives will be taken.
Can we go up in the lighthouse?
Rose asks, changing the subject. I want to show Heath. Her eyebrows lift, and she bites the side of her cheek, looking like a cherub all rosy-cheeked and saucer-eyed. I can't help but love her, the way she always brightens the air around her, as if she were a light bulb, like she were a summer day and a cool breeze all in one.
Okay, I say,
and she smiles big and dopey, tugging me up the boardwalk with Heath following.
I seem to recall a boy with you last night,
she whispers in my ear, her breath hot and sharp with alcohol. Beau, I answer. I gave him a job on the island. He's staying in an anchor cottage.
You did what?
Her mouth drops open.
He needed work.
You must have been drunk if you were willing to take in an outsider. You realize he's probably just a tourist.
I don't think so.
Then why is he here?
I'm not sure.
Penny, she says, slowing her pace up the path. He's living on the island with you. He could murder you in your sleep.
I think he has more to fear than I do.
True, she agrees, pulling down the sleeves of her white sweater so her fingers are tucked in out of the cold wind. He couldn't have shown up at a worse time. We'll see if he makes it until summer solstice. A chill shuttles down my spine. Once we reach the lighthouse, Rose giggles as she sways unsteadily up the spiral staircase, and Heath keeps grabbing onto her to prevent her from tumbling backward. At the top of the stairs, I push through the door into the lantern room. But it's not dark like I was expecting. The lamp resting on the white desk on the right side wall has been switched on, and a silhouette is standing at the glass, one shoulder leaning against it.
Beau?
I ask.
Hey.
He turns around and I notice a book held in his right hand.
I came up to watch the storm.
Us too, Rose squeaks. She steps forward to introduce herself. I'm Rose.
Beau.
Rose grins and looks back at me, mouthing, he's cute, so no one else will see. Beau and Heath shake hands. Then Heath holds up the bottle.
Looks like we have a small party. I should probably head down,
Beau offers, tucking the book under his arm.
No way, Rose says, grinning.
You're staying. 3 isn't a party, but 4 is perfect. Beau glances at me, as if looking for permission, but I stare back at him blankly, unsure what to think about him up here all alone, reading or watching the storm. Whatever the truth might be.
All right,
he agrees, a hint of reluctance in his eyes. Heath produces an opener from his coat pocket and begins uncorking the bottle. Heath stole 2 bottles from his parents' B&B, Rose says. We drank one on the way over. Which explains why she's already so tipsy. There aren't any glasses, so Heath takes a swig, but before he passes it around, he says,
Should we take bets?
On what? Rose asks.
How long until the first body turns up in the harbor?
That's morbid, Rose says with a grimace.
Maybe, but it's going to happen whether we want it to or not.
Beau and I exchange a look. Rose exhales a breath through her nose. 3 days, she says meekly, grabbing the bottle from Heath's hand and taking a drink.
3 and a half,
Heath guesses, eyeing her. But I think he only says it to be cute, playing off her number. Rose hands the bottle to Beau, and he holds it low,
looking down at it like the answer is somewhere inside.
I hope it doesn't happen at all, he finally says.
That's not really a guess, Rose points out, lifting an eyebrow.
Sure it is, Heath defends.
He's guessing no days, which has never happened, but I suppose it's possible. Maybe no one will drown this summer.
Unlikely, Rose adds, looking a little disgusted with this whole game.
Beau takes a quick slug of the red wine, then holds it out for me. I take it carefully, sliding my thumb down the neck of the bottle, then look up at the group.
Tonight, I say, tipping the bottle to my lips and taking a full swig.
Rose shivers slightly, and Heath wraps an arm around her.
Let's talk about something else, she suggests. Whatever you want.
And he smiles down at her.
I want to count ghosts, she chirps, her mood returned.
Heath releases her and frowns, confused.
You want to do what?
It's a game Penny and I used to play when we were kids. Remember, Penny?
She looks to me and I nod.
We look for ghosts in the beam of light from the lighthouse as it circles around the island. You get points for everyone that you see. 1 point if you see it on the island, and 2 points if you see one out in the water.
And you actually see these ghosts?
Heath asks, one eyebrow scrunching up into his forehead.
Yes, they're everywhere,
Rose answers with an artful smirk.
You just have to know where to look.
Show me, Heath says. And even though he's obviously skeptical, he smiles as she drags him to the window. It's a childish game, but they press their palms against the glass, laughing already. I hand the bottle back to Beau, and he takes another drink.
What are you reading? I ask.
A book I found in the cottage.
About what?
He slides it out from under his arm and sets it on the white desk. The History and Legend of Sparrow, Oregon. The front cover is an old photograph of the harbor taken from Ocean Avenue. A cobblestone sidewalk is in the foreground, and the harbor is crowded with old fishing boats and massive steamships. It's more of a pamphlet than a real book, and you can find it at just about every coffee shop and restaurant and in the lobby of each bed and breakfast in town. It's a tourist's guide to everything that happened in Sparrow 2 centuries ago and everything that has occurred since. It was written by Anderson Fotts, an artist and poet who used to live in Sparrow, until his son drowned 7 years ago, and then he moved away. Brushing up on your town's history, huh?
Not much else to do in the evening around here.
He has a point. I stare down at the book, knowing its contents all too well. On page 37 is a portrait of the 3 Swan Sisters sketched by Thomas Renshaw, a man who claimed to have met the sisters before they were drowned. Marguerite stands on the left, the tallest of the 3, with long auburn hair, full lips, and a sharp jaw, her eyes staring straight ahead. Aurora is in the middle with soft waves of hair and bright full moon eyes. Hazel, on the right, has plain, smaller features and a braid twisted across her shoulder. Her eyes are focused away, like she's looking at something in the distance. They are all beautiful, captivating, as if they were shifting slightly on the page.
So you believe in the sisters now? I ask.
I haven't decided.
The beam of light slides across his face, and I follow it out to sea, where it cuts through the storm and the impending rain, warning sailors and fishermen that an island lies in their path.
You shouldn't go into town if you don't have to from now on, I tell him.
Both his eyebrows lift.
Why not?
It's safer if you stay here on the island. You can't trust anyone in town. Any girl you meet could be one of them. His eyelids lower, partly concealing the dark tint of his green eyes, verdant and rueful. He is familiar in a way I can't pin down, like seeing someone you knew a long time ago, but they've changed in the passing years, become someone different and new.
Even you?
He asks, like I'm joking.
Even me.
I want him to understand how serious I am.
So, no talking to girls?
He clarifies. Precisely. The right side of his mouth turns up into a grin, a fractional parting of lips, and he looks like he might laugh, but then he takes a sip from the bottle instead. I know it sounds absurd, maybe even a little irrational, to warn him against speaking to any girls, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. Most local boys, if they truly believe in the legend, will steer clear of all girls until the summer solstice. Better to minimize the risk. But Beau, like most outsiders, won't take it seriously. He's in danger just by being in this town.
That's three! Rose bellows from the window, and Heath shakes his head.
Apparently, Rose is winning the ghost hunting game, as usual.
Where are you from?
I ask Beau, after the beam of light passes around the lighthouse a full three times.
Washington.
I arch an eyebrow at him, expecting him to narrow it down to a city or county or nearest proximity to a Starbucks. But he doesn't.
That's extremely vague, I say.
Can you be more specific?
His cheekbones tightened, a rivulet of tension.
Near the middle is all he offers up.
I can see this won't be easy. I rub my tongue along the roof of my mouth.
What?
Figuring out who you really are.
He taps his finger against the side of the bottle, a rhythm to a song, I think.
What do you want to know?
He asks. Did you go to high school in this fictional near-the-middle town? Again, I think he's going to smile, but he stifles it before it escapes his lips.
Yeah, I graduated this year.
So you graduated, then promptly escaped your make-believe town?
Basically.
Why'd you leave?
He ceases the tapping against the bottle. My brother died.
A blast of wind and sideways rain sprays the windows, and I flinch.
I'm sorry.
Beau shakes his head and tips the bottle to his lips. The minutes pass, and the question resting inside my throat starts to feel strangled, cutting off the air to my lungs.
How did he die?
It was an accident.
He swirls the bottle, and the carmine wine spins up the sides. A mini cyclone. He looks away from me, like he's considering heading for the door and leaving, saying goodnight and vanishing into the storm. And although I'm curious exactly what kind of accident, I don't press it any further. I can tell he doesn't want to talk about it. And I don't want him to leave, even though our conversation feels tightened along the edges, tugged and constrained because he's holding things in. I'm also not quite ready for this night to be over. There are things I like about him. No, that's not right. It's not him, exactly. It's me. I like how I feel standing beside him, eased by his presence. The steady buzz along my thoughts, the ache in my chest tamped down, softened. So I take the bottle from him and sit cross-legged on the cold floor, staring out at the storm. I know what it is to lose the people around you. And I take a long, slow drink of the wine, warming my stomach and making my head swim, wiping away the hangover. Beau sits beside me, forearms resting on his bent knees.
Have you been in a lot of fights before?
I ask after a stretch of silence.
What?
On the beach last night with Lon, you seemed like you weren't afraid to fight him.
I don't like fighting, if that's what you mean. But yeah, I've been in a few, although not because I wanted to.
He exhales slowly, and I think he's going to change the subject. His lips stall partway open.
My brother was always getting himself into trouble, he continues. He liked taking risks, jumping into rivers in the middle of winter, climbing bridges to watch the sunrise, driving his truck too fast down the center line just for the rush, things like that. And sometimes he'd say things he shouldn't, or hit on girls he shouldn't, and find himself in a fistfight.
Beau shakes his head.
He thought it was funny, but I was always the one who had to step in and save him, keep him from getting his ass kicked. He was my older brother, but my parents were always asking me to keep an eye on him. But since he died...
His gaze dips to the floor, voice trailing, memories sliding through him.
I haven't had to defend him.
I hand him the bottle of wine, and he takes a long drink. Holding it between his knees with both hands, he asks, "Do you ever think about leaving this town?" I lift my chin. "Of course."
"But?"
"It's complicated." His thumb taps the neck of the bottle.
"Isn't that what people say when they just don't want to admit the truth?"
"Probably, but the truth is complicated. My life is complicated."
"So after you graduate, you're not going to leave Sparrow? You're not going to college somewhere?"
I shrug. "Maybe. It's not something I think about." I shift uneasily on the floor, wishing we could change the subject back to him.
"What's keeping you here?"
I almost laugh, but don't, because the answer isn't funny. Nothing about the reasons why I'm stuck here is funny. "My family," I finally say, because I have to say something. "My mom."
"She doesn't want you to leave?"
"It's not that. She's not well." I look away from him, shaking my head. The truth slips between the edges of the lies.
"You don't want to talk about it?"
he asks. "Just like you don't want to talk about where you're from," I say softly. "Or what happened to..." I almost bring up his brother again, but stop myself. He makes a low exhaling sound, then hands the bottle back to me. We're swapping sips of wine instead of sharing the truth, like a drinking game we just invented. If you don't want to talk about something, take a drink.
"There are always reasons to stay," he says. "You just need to find one reason to leave."
His eyes hold mine, and something familiar stirs inside me, something I want to pretend isn't there. A flicker that illuminates the darkest part of my insides, and I absorb it like sunlight. "I guess I haven't found that reason yet," I say. I know my cheeks are blazing pink. I can feel the heat against my skin. But I don't look away from him. The storm blows against the windows, rattling the glass and the casings. Beau looks out at the rain, and I watch his gaze, wishing I could pluck more thoughts from his head. Pain rests behind his eyes, and I feel myself suddenly wanting to touch his face, his skin, his fingertips. Then, like a machine being switched off, the wind outside stops. The rain scatters and turns to mist, and the moody black clouds begin to push farther south, revealing a backdrop of black sky with pinhole pricks for stars. Rose hops up from the floor and twirls herself in a circle. "We need to go make wishes," she announces. "Tonight."
"The shipwreck?"
Heath asks from his place, still sprawled out on the floor. "The shipwreck," she repeats.
"What's the shipwreck?"
Beau asks, flinching his gaze away from mine for the first time. "You'll see," Rose answers. We tromp through the darkness and down the wood path to the dock. Heath insists we take his boat, and we pile into the small, narrow dinghy. Beau takes my hand, even though I don't need it to keep my balance. I'm as steady on the water as I am on land, and he doesn't let go until I'm seated beside him on one of the benches. The interior is sparse and tidy, a stack of orange life vests strapped to the gunwale. Heath pulls on the engine cord once, and the motor revs to life. Maybe I shouldn't go with them. It's late, and my head rocks gently with the sloppiness of wine purring through my bloodstream. But the looseness is also addictive. It rounds out the rough edges of my mind. The worry that is constant there, that lives beneath my fingernails and at the base of my neck. So I grip the edge of the bench seat, and slowly we chug across the eerily calm harbor. It's as if the water has died, surrendered after the storm. The ruins of sunken ships are like tombstones, jutting up from the water ahead of us. Jagged spikes of metal, rusted, turning to sand from the relentless tide. I wish we had more wine, Rose murmurs, but her voice is soft and unconcerned, so no one responds. The green mast, covered in a layer of moss and algae, rises the tallest of all the wreckage in the harbor. The flag that once hung from its peak long ago disintegrated and blown away. Heath slows the boat as we approach, then kills the engine entirely, so that we drift within only a few feet of the mast. Dark, murky outlines of the rest of the ship sit beneath us, close enough to tear apart the propeller on Heath's boat if he didn't shut off the motor when he did. It's dangerous to be this close to the wreckage, but it's also why kids come out here. To test their nerve. If it weren't dangerous, it wouldn't be fun. Did anyone bring coins? Rose asks. Beau looks from Rose to me.
For what?
To make a wish, I tell him.
This was a pirate ship, Heath explains.
The legend says that if you drop a coin down to the dead pirates who still haunt the ship, they will grant you a wish. There's probably hundreds. No, thousands of dollars and quarters down there, Rose says, waving a hand in the air as if she were a magician. Or just a pile of pennies, I say. Heath checks his pockets and produces a dime and a quarter. Beau pulls out three quarters and several pennies. The higher denomination the coin, the greater the chance that they'll grant your wish. Pirates are greedy, obviously. Rose says as she snatches the quarter from Heath's palm. Beau and I each take a penny, and Heath holds the dime. Apparently, Beau and I aren't very optimistic about our wishes actually coming true. But still, I know what my wish will be. The same wish I've always had. We each extend our arms over the side of the boat, fists clenched, and Rose counts us down from three. Two... One, she says, and we all open our palms and let our coins plop into the water. They flit down quickly, reflective at first as they sink among the serrated, cavernous angles of wreckage, and then they're gone. We are still for a moment, holding our breath, waiting for something immediate to happen. But when nothing does, Beau lets out a breath of air, and I cross my arms, feeling chilled. Anxious, even. We shouldn't be here, I think suddenly. Out on the water so soon after the sisters have returned. It's dangerous. Risky for Heath and Beau. And something doesn't feel right. We should head back to the island, I suggest, trying not to sound panicked, looking up at Heath, hoping he'll start the engine. The ocean seems too calm. The singing now gone, the storm passed. Only a ripple laps up against the side of the boat. I sense it, even before I see it. The temperature drops. The sky yawns open so huge that the stars could swallow us like a whale drinking down a school of fish. The sea vibrates. My eyes lock on something dark, swaying with the current. A body is drifting face up, only a couple yards from the boat. Eyes open but lost of all color. The first dead boy. Oh my God! Rose screeches, eyes bursting to globes, finger pointing at the corpse. The arms are spread wide, the legs half sunk beneath the water, and a navy blue sweatshirt hangs from the torso like it's two sizes too big. Shit! Heath mutters under his breath. Like he's afraid to speak too loudly or he might wake the dead. The moon breaks through the clouds, shining over the water. But it's not a milky white. It's a pale red. Blood on the moon. A bad omen. We shouldn't have come out here.
Who is it?
Rose asks, her voice trembling, fingers reaching for something to grab onto. Like she's reaching for the body. The face comes into view. Ashen, hollow cheeks. Short blonde hair swaying outward from a pale scalp.
Gregory Dunn. Heath answers, wiping a palm over his face.
He graduated this year. Was going to college out east in the fall. Boston, I think. Beau and I are completely silent. He touches the side of the boat, blinks, but doesn't speak.
We have to do something, Rose says, standing up suddenly. We can't leave him in the water.
She takes a step forward toward the starboard side of the dinghy, which has now drifted closer to the body. But her movements shift the boat off center, and it rocks toward the water.
Rose!
I bark, reaching out for her. Heath makes an attempt to grab for her too, but the momentum has tipped the boat too far, and she stumbles, her legs unbalanced, hands scrambling to brace herself on something. She pitches head first into the icy water. Beau, for the first time, reacts. He's at the side of the boat before I've even had time to process what's happened. Ripples cascade outward toward the corpse of Gregory Dunn. Thankfully, Rose didn't land on him when she went over. Beau leans over the starboard side of the boat, plunges his arms down into the frigid water, wrapping his hands around Rose's arms, and hoists her in one swift motion back into the boat. She collapses instantly, knees pulled up, shaking and convulsing uncontrollably. Heath grabs a blanket from under one of the seats and wraps it around her.
We need to get her to shore,
Beau says in a rush, and Heath starts the motor again. I crouch down next to Rose, an arm wrapped around her, and we race toward the marina, leaving the body of Gregory Dunn behind. When we reach the shore, I walk quickly up the docks to the metal bell that hangs from a wood archway facing the harbor. The death bell, everyone calls it. Whenever a body is discovered, someone will ring the bell to alert the town that a body has been found. It was installed 20 years ago. And during the month of June, up until the summer solstice, the bell becomes the tolling sound of death. Each time it rings, locals wince, and the tourists grab their cameras. I reach for the rough fiber of the rope and clank it twice against the inside of the bell. A hollow tolling sound echoes up through the town, bouncing among the damp walls of shops and homes, waking everyone from sleep. It takes an hour for the police and local fishermen to finally head back into port, having retrieved the body of Gregory Dunn from the water. They took their time collecting any evidence, of which there will be none. No blood, no marks, no sign of a struggle. There never is. Rose is shivering beside me, sipping numbly on a cup of hot chocolate that Heath retrieved from the chowder, which opened early, 3 a.m., to serve the townspeople who awoke to come see the first body pulled from the sea. We all wait on the docks, watching the parade of boats slice through the water. People stand in their pajamas and wool caps and rain boots. Even children have been pulled from bed, stumbling down with blankets slung over their shoulders to see this annual, gruesome event. But the local police have learned to minimize the spectacle, and when they move the body onto a stretcher on the dock, they make sure it's completely covered. But people still snap photos. Kids still begin to cry, and people gasp, then cover their mouths with gloved hands.
You were right,
Beau whispers against my ear when the ambulance whirls away with Gregory Dunn's body strapped onto a cold metal stretcher in the back.
You said it would happen tonight, and it did.
I shake my head. It's not a contest I wanted to win. The crowd around us slowly dissolves,
and people begin tromping back to their beds or to the chowder to discuss this first drowning. Heath approaches, eyebrows cut sharply into a gray frown.
"I'm going to take Rose home," he says. "She's pretty shook up."
"Okay." I glance to Rose, who has already slipped away from my side and is walking up the dock, the striped red and gray blanket from Heath's boat falling from her shoulders. She looks stunned, and I know I should probably go with her, but she seems to only want Heath right now, so I let him take her.
"I'll come back to take you guys over to the island," Heath says before walking after Rose.
I nod. Then Beau and I follow the drowsy stream of people to Shipley Pier, where a waitress at the chowder is wearing blue polka dot pajamas and fuzzy Ugg boots. "Coffee?" she asks us. I scan her face, settling on her eyes, but she looks normal. Human.
"Sure," Beau answers.
"Black tea, please," I tell her. She frowns briefly and makes a snort sound, like my request for tea will require more effort than she's willing to give at this hour. But she shuffles away in her boots, and Beau and I stand at the end of the pier, leaning against the railing and facing out to sea, waiting for the sunrise. Voices murmur all around us, and speculation begins to circulate almost immediately. Over the next couple weeks, we will be in the middle of an all-out witch hunt. Several girls from school have gathered on the outdoor deck, sipping coffee and popping bits of blueberry muffin and biscotti into their mouths, chatting loudly even though it's the middle of the night, and they can't possibly be fully awake. I examine their features, the hue of their eyes, the chalky porcelain of their skin. I'm looking for something unnatural, a gossamer creature suspended behind human flesh. But I don't see it. The waitress brings us our drinks without even a smile.
"How could Gregory Dunn have been led into the harbor without anyone seeing?"
Beau asks, keeping his voice low, holding his coffee between his hands, but not yet taking a drink. I lift my shoulders, biting my lower lip. "The Swan Sisters don't want to be seen," I say. "They've been doing this for 200 years. They're good at it. They're good at not getting caught." I circle a finger around the rim of my white cup.
"You say it like you don't want them to get caught, like the town deserves it."
"Maybe it does." The anger I feel for this town, these people, burns inside me. It beats against my skull. So many injustices. So much death. They've always treated outsiders cruelly, cast them off because they didn't belong. "The sisters were killed by the people of this town," I say, my voice weighted with something that doesn't quite sound like me. "Drowned unfairly because they fell in love with the wrong men. Maybe they have a right to their revenge."
"To kill innocent people?
How do you know Gregory Dunn didn't deserve it?"
I can hardly believe my own words. "I don't," he says sharply. "But I doubt every person who's been drowned did deserve it."
I know he's right, yet I feel inclined to argue the point. I just want him to understand why it happens. Why the sisters return every year. It's not without cause. "It's their retribution," I say. Beau stands up straight and takes a sip of his coffee. "Look, I'm not saying it's right," I add. "But you can't start thinking that you can prevent it or change what happens here. Gregory Dunn was just the first. There will be more. Trying to stop it has only ever made things worse."
"What do you mean?"
"The town has killed innocent girls because they thought they were inhabited by one of the sisters. It's just better to leave it alone. There's nothing you can do." The sun starts to edge up from the east, dull and pink at first. At the marina, fishermen begin slogging down the docks to their boats. And then I spot Heath, walking down Ocean Avenue, returned to give us a ride back to the island. Bo doesn't speak, his mind likely wheeling over thoughts that don't line up, trying to resolve what he's seen tonight. A dead body. A 2-centuries-long curse. A town that has accepted its fate. It's a lot to take in, and he only just got here. It's going to get worse. We start down the pier, the light changing, turning pale orange as it streaks over the town. 2 girls are walking toward us, heading to the chowder. My gaze slides over them briefly. It's Olivia and Lola, the best friends who danced around the bonfire at the swan party shortly after the singing started. They are both fully dressed, no PJs or messy hair, as if the death of Gregory Dunn were a social event they wouldn't dare miss. One they were expecting. Lola's dyed black hair is woven back in a French braid. Olivia's is loose across her shoulders, long and wavy. Her nose ring glints against the encroaching sun. And when my eyes meet hers, I know. Marguerite Swan is occupying her body. The white, spectral image of Marguerite hovers beneath Olivia's soft skin, like looking through a thin pane of glass, or beneath the surface of a lake all the way down to the sandy bottom. It isn't a clear, crisp outline of Marguerite, but like a memory of her, wavy and unsettled, drifting inside this poor girl's body. I found her. A part of me had dared to hope I wouldn't see them this year, that I could avoid the sisters, avoid the ritual of death that befalls this town. But I won't be so lucky after all. I wish I weren't staring through Olivia's snow-white skin at Marguerite hidden beneath. But I am, and I'm the only one standing on Shipley Pier who can. This is the secret I can't tell Bo. The reason why I know the Swan Sisters are real. Her lurid gaze settles on me. Not Olivia's. Olivia is gone. But Marguerite's. And then she smiles faintly at me as they stride past. I feel briefly paralyzed. My upper lip twitches. They continue down the pier, Lola chatting about something that my ears can't seem to focus on, oblivious that her best friend is no longer her best friend. Just before they reach the chowder, I glance over my shoulder at them. Olivia's hair swings effortlessly over her shoulders and down her back. "You all right?" Bo asks, turning to look at Olivia and Lola. "We need to get back to the island," I say, spinning back around. "It's not safe here." Marguerite has found a host in the body of Olivia Green. And Marguerite is always the first to make a kill. Gregory Dunn was hers. The drowning season has started. Perfumery. The Swan Sisters might have dabbled in witchcraft in the years before they arrived in Sparrow, an occasional hex or potion to detour jealous wives or bad spirits, but they certainly wouldn't call themselves witches, as the people of Sparrow had accused. They were businesswomen, shop owners, and when they arrived in Sparrow 2 centuries ago, they brought with them an array of exotic scents to be crafted into delicate perfumes and fragrant balms. At first, the women in town gathered together inside the Swan Perfumery, swooning over scents that reminded them of the civilized world. They purchased small glass bottles of rose water and honey, lemongrass and gardenia, all perfectly blended, subtle and intricate. It wasn't until Marguerite, the oldest of the sisters at 19, was caught in bed with a ship's captain that everything began to crumble. The sisters couldn't be blamed. It wasn't witchcraft that seduced the men of Sparrow. It was something much simpler. The Swan Sisters had a charm that was born into their blood, like their mother. Men could not resist the softness of their skin or the gleam of their aquamarine eyes. Love came easily and often for them. While Marguerite liked older men with money and power, Aurora fell for boys who others said couldn't be seduced. She liked a challenge, typically falling for more than one boy at a time. Hazel was more particular, precise. She didn't delight in the affection of numerous men like her sisters, yet they adored her anyway. A trail of heartbroken boys often left in her wake. The sisters brought about their fate like someone stumbling into a poison ivy bush in the dark, unaware of the consequences that would befall them by morning. Chapter 7. For 3 awful weeks, tourists and locals will accuse nearly every girl of being a Swan sister. Any offense, any deviation in behavior, a sudden interest in boys they used to despise, spending too many nights out late, a twitch or flick of an eye that seems out of place, will make you a suspect. But I know who the sisters really are. Heath gives us a ride across the harbor, and when we reach the island, we all say a swift goodbye, and then Heath chugs back to town. Beau and I don't speak as we walk up the path until we reach the place where the walkway splits. A mound of old buoys and crab pots that have washed ashore over the years sit just to the left of the walkway, a decomposing heap, a reminder that this place has more death than life. "I'm sorry," I say. "We never should have gone out there. I'm used to the gruesome shock of death, but Beau isn't, and I'm sure he's starting to consider leaving this place as soon as possible. I wouldn't blame him if he did."
"It wasn't your fault."
His eyelashes lower, and he kicks a pebble from the walkway. It lands in a patch of yellow grass and vanishes. "You should get some sleep. We've both been awake all night, and the delirium of exhaustion is starting to feel like a freight train clamoring back and forth between my ears." He nods, removes his hands from his coat pockets, and heads up the path to Anchor Cottage. He doesn't even say goodbye. I won't be surprised if he starts packing as soon as he gets back to the cottage. Mom is already awake and listening to the radio in the kitchen when I walk through the back door. It's a local station that announces storm warnings and tide reports. And today, the host, Buddy Cogens, is talking about the body that authorities pulled from the water early this morning. "This town is black with death," she says morosely, facing the kitchen sink, her hands gripping the white tile edge. "It's saturated with it." I don't answer her. I'm too tired. So I slip out into the hall and upstairs to my bedroom. From the window, I see Beau moving up the path, almost to Anchor Cottage near the center of the island. His gait is slow and deliberate. He looks back once, as if he feels me watching him, and I duck back from the window. Something nags at me. I just can't put my finger on it. The afternoon sky shatters apart, revealing a swath of milky blue. Last night, we found Gregory Dunn's body in the harbor. This morning, we watched the sunrise from the pier as his body was brought ashore. Day 1 of the swan season. 1 boy dead. I slip from bed, rubbing my eyes, still groggy even though the sun has been up for hours, and dress in an old pair of faded jeans and a navy blue sweater. I take my time. I stand at the dresser, not meeting my own gaze in the mirror on the wall, running my fingers over a meager collection of things. A bottle of old perfume, Mom's, which I bring to my nose. The vanilla scent has turned sharp and musty, taken on the tinge of alcohol. There is a silver dish filled with pebbles gathered from the shore, aqua and coral and emerald green. 2 candles sit at one corner of the dresser, the wicks hardly burned down. And hanging by a length of yellow ribbon from the top of the mirror is a triangle piece of glass with flowers pressed between it. I can't dredge up the memory of where it came from. A birthday gift, maybe? Something Rose gave me? I stare at it, the small pink flowers flattened and dried, preserved for eternity.
I turn and lean against the dresser, taking stock of the room. Sparse and tidy. White walls. White everything. Clean. No bright colors anywhere. My room says little about me. Or maybe it says it all. A room easily abandoned, left behind with hardly a hint that a girl ever lived here at all. Mom is not in the house. The floorboards groan as I walk down the stairs into the kitchen. A plate of freshly baked orange muffins sits on the table. That's two mornings in a row she's made breakfast. The two mornings that Beau's been on the island. She can't help herself. She won't let a stranger starve, even though she'd easily let herself or me go hungry. Old habits. The social decorum of a small town. Feed anyone who comes to visit. I grab two muffins, then head out onto the front porch. The air is warm, calm and placated. Seagulls spin in dizzying circles overhead, swooping down to the steep shoreline and snatching up fish caught in the tide pools. I catch the silhouette of Mom inside the greenhouse, walking among the decomposing plants. I peer across the island to Anchor Cottage. Is Beau still inside? Or did he pack his bag and find a way off the island while I slept? A knot tightens in my stomach. If I find the cottage empty, cold and dark, how will I feel? Despair? Like my gut has been ripped out? But at least I'll know he's safe. Escaped this town before he wound up like Gregory Dunn. A noise draws my focus away from the cottage. A low sawing sound. A cutting of wood. It echoes over the island. And it's coming from the orchard. I follow the wood slat path deeper into the island. But before I've even stepped into the rows of perfectly spaced trees, I can tell that things are different. The wood ladder that normally rests at the farthest row against a half-dead Anjou tree, protected from the wind, has been moved closer to the center of the grove and has been positioned beside one of the Braeburn trees. And standing on the highest rung, leaning into the thicket of branches, is Beau. He didn't leave after all. He didn't do the smart thing and flee when he had the opportunity. Relief swells inside my chest.
Hey,
he says down to me, holding on to one of the low branches. The sun makes long shadows through the trees.
Is everything okay?
He takes several steps down the ladder, his hat turned backward on his head. Fine, I answer. I just thought maybe you'd... My voice dissipates.
What?
Nothing. I'm just glad you're still here. He squints and wipes at his forehead.
You thought I would leave?
Maybe. The sunlight catches his eyes, making the dark green seem like pieces of emerald glass, an entire world contained within them. His gray t-shirt sticks to his chest and arms. His cheeks are flushed. I watch him a moment too long. Have you slept? I ask.
Not yet.
He smiles from one side of his mouth. His mood seems to have lifted slightly since this morning. While I was curled up in bed, sheets pulled over my head to block out the sun, he's been out here working. Sleep probably seemed like an impossibility after last night, after what he saw. I wanted to get started on the orchard. He hooks a wide-toothed handsaw over a low, crooked limb, then climbs down the ladder, brushing his hands across his jeans. I hand him one of the freshly baked orange muffins. What are you doing exactly? He cranes his head up to the tangled limbs above us, squinting. The scar beneath his left eye pinches together.
Cutting out any new growth. We only want the oldest limbs to stay because those are the ones that produce fruit. And see how some of the branches grow straight up or down? Those also need to go.
He blinks away from the sun, then looks at me. Can I help? He sets the muffin on a rung of the ladder, then lifts the hat from his head and scrubs a hand through his short hair.
If you want to.
I do. He drags out a second ladder from the old woodshed and finds another, smaller handsaw. He places the ladder against the tree next to the one he had been pruning, and I climb carefully to the top, a little unsteady at first as it wobbles beneath me. Once I feel settled, I realize I'm shrouded by a veil of limbs, hidden in a world of branches. And then Beau climbs up behind me, standing one rung down. He extends the handsaw up to me and then wraps his arms around my waist, gripping the ladder to keep me from falling.
"What do you see?"
he asks, his voice at my neck, my ear, and I shiver slightly at the feeling of his breath against my skin.
"I'm not sure," I say truthfully.
"The trees haven't bloomed yet," he explains, "but they will soon, so we have to take out all the branches that are crowding the older limbs. The old wood, it's called." "This small one," I say, tapping it with my finger, "it's growing straight up from a thicker branch, and it still looks a little green."
"Exactly,"
he praises. And I lift the saw, holding it to the limb. On my first stroke across the branch, the saw slips out, and I lurch forward to keep from dropping it. Beau tightens his arms around me, and the ladder teeters beneath us. My heartbeat spikes upward.
"The saw takes some getting used to," Beau adds.
I nod, gripping the top of the ladder. And then I feel the sharp stinging in my left index finger. I turn my palm up so I can examine it, and blood beads to the surface along the outer edge of my finger. When the blade slipped, it must have cut into my skin where my hand was holding the branch. Beau notices it at the same time, and he leans closer into me, reaching around to grab my finger.
"You're cut," he says.
The blood drips down the tip of my finger and plummets all the way to the ground, 6 feet below. I notice Otis and Olga sitting in the swath of sun between rows, orange and white heads tilted upward, watching us. "It's okay," I say, but he yanks out a white handkerchief from his back pocket and presses it to the cut, staunching the bleeding. "It's not that deep," I add, even though it stings pretty good. The white fabric turns red almost instantly.
"We should clean it out," he says.
"No, really, I'm fine." This close, with his face directly beside mine, I can feel each breath as it rises in his chest, see his lips move as he exhales. His heart is racing faster than it should, like he was worried I might have just cut my entire hand off, and it would have been his fault for allowing me to wield a saw. He lifts the handkerchief away to inspect the cut, leaning into me. "Do we need to amputate?" I ask lightheartedly.
"Most likely."
His eyes slide to mine, the corner of his mouth lifting. He tears off a small strip of the handkerchief, holding my hand in his, then ties the narrow piece of fabric around my finger like a makeshift tourniquet.
"This should keep the finger from falling off until we operate."
"Thanks," I say, smiling even though it still burns. My lips so close to his, I can almost taste the saltiness of his skin. He slides what's left of his handkerchief into his back pocket and straightens up behind me so that his chest is no longer against my back.
"It's probably safer with just one person on the ladder," he amends.
I nod, agreeing, and he climbs down, jumping the last couple of feet to the ground and leaving me weightless atop the ladder without him. He scales back up his ladder, and we work side by side, sawing away the unwanted limbs on each tree. I'm careful to keep my fingers out of the way, and soon I feel confident with the saw. It's a tedious, slow process, but gradually we work our way down the first row. This becomes our routine. Each morning we meet in the orchard, moving our ladders to a new row, bringing the fruit trees back to life. I don't mind the work. It feels purposeful. And by the end of the week, my hands have a roughness like I've never felt before. My skin has browned, and my eyes taper away from the midday sun. It hasn't rained once all week, and the summer air feels light and buoyant and sweet. On Saturday, we collect all the sawn limbs and pile them at the north end of the orchard, and just after sunset, we set them ablaze. The sooty night sky sparks and shivers,